There's an anonymous story online that goes something like this. Once upon a time, a man spread rumors that his neighbor was a thief. As a result, the neighbor was arrested. But a few days later, he was proven innocent of the charges. Now, the neighbor felt humiliated after his release and decided to sue the man for falsely accusing him. In court, the man told the judge they were just comments. They didn't harm anyone. But before passing sentence on the case, the judge told the man to write down all the comments he made about his neighbor. He was to then cut up the pieces of paper and, on the way home, release the pieces into the wind. After he did that, he was to come back the next day to hear his sentence. Well, the man did as the judge instructed, and upon returning the next day, was told that before sentence would be passed, the man had to go and find all the pieces of paper he threw out yesterday. Well, I can't do that, the man exclaimed. The wind must have spread them, and I won't know where to find them. The same way, simple comments may destroy the honor of a person to such an extent that one is not able to fix it, the judge replied. Suddenly, the man realized his error and asked his neighbor for forgiveness. Now, what strikes me about this story is we're never given a glimpse of the man's thought processes. Did he genuinely believe his neighbor had committed the theft? Did he have what he believed to be evidence that seemed to show the truth of his words? If he was hooked up to a polygraph prior to his neighbor being proven innocent, would he have been able to show that he was telling the truth, or at least the truth as he saw it? The moral for me out of this story is that our truth can easily destroy the lives and reputations of others, to no fault of their own. Words and actions, even those we believe to be true, can have devastating consequences for other people. When they do, no amount of apologies can truly ever fix things, because the consequences are carried throughout the world by the various winds. What if the neighbor hadn't been proven innocent? What if they sat in prison for years for a crime they didn't commit? Imagine if their family and friends had turned their backs on them, wrongly believing that their loved one was someone whom they didn't truly know, turned into a monster by those they loved the most. Some may say I'm exaggerating and that this is just a new take on a fable. But people's lives have been irreparably altered over false accusations. Remember Richard Jewell? He was a security guard who, in 1996, discovered the bomb that went off at the Olympic Games and was able to evacuate people before too many were injured. Unfortunately, people's suspicion started turning to him. He was accused of planting the bomb. Multiple news outlets directly accused him of being guilty. And even after he was exonerated, even after it was proven that it was not him, but rather a serial bomber who had also attacked an abortion clinic and a federal building, Richard Jewell's reputation was destroyed. It was all on the word of several news outlets who were very, very, very excited to break the story before any other, whether they had the evidence for it or not. Even though these outlets could argue they were merely searching for the truth, was their search responsible if it destroyed the career and reputation of an innocent man? In the search for truth, for who committed a deadly crime, an innocent man's life was made a sacrifice. A man's life hung on the fate of wild rumors which spread about him, tossed into the wind wherever they would go. Our focus for the month of November has been the fourth principle, the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Now, understandably, given our movement's traditional advocacy of religious freedom, it's the free part that's usually emphasized when talking about this principle. And none of this is to say that freedom of conscience and conviction is unimportant. It absolutely is. However, our spiritual ancestors, in their wisdom, realized that freedom had to be tempered, that unrestrained freedom could lead to abuse and potentially tear apart congregations and even our movement. To give an example from our Unitarian and Universalist history, consider the widespread support the theory of eugenics once enjoyed within our ranks. Throughout the late 19th and early to mid 20th century, many within our ranks directly or indirectly supported the idea that the perfect human race could be created through scientific interventions in the human evolution by simply getting rid of those who were less than perfect. A well-known quote from Supreme Court Justice and Unitarian Oliver Wendell Holmes declared, "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sapped the strength of the state for lesser sacrifices. It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." The problem with eugenics is that it advanced a free search for truth and meaning without considering the consequences for the people who fell short of this perfect benchmark. Women, usually poor, mentally ill, immigrants, or women of color, were forcibly sterilized without their knowledge or consent in what was believed to be a necessary act to prevent more of Holmes' imbeciles. Immigration from non-Western European countries was either severely limited or forbidden altogether. And eugenics provided an excuse to deny people of color, the economically poor, immigrants, and the physically and mentally disabled their full rights. Eugenics propagated a theory of supremacy and tossed it to the wind without any regard for where its seeds would land. And it was only World War II and Hitler's adoption of the theory that caused many Unitarians and Universalists to reconsider their support. But by then, the damage had been done in the lives of so many innocent people, sometimes permanently in the cases of women who were denied the ability to ever have a family. And like the neighbor in my opening story, the consequences were far and wide. The devastation of finding out one would never have children. The pain of seeing fellow humans treat you like a subpar object that doesn't belong to the world. And for our movement, it meant that we've never been able to live up to our stated aspiration of attracting all people who would covenant to walk with us, regardless of class, race, ability, and national origin. Classism and racism are legacies which continue to influence our movement to this day, with little end in sight. And yes, most people who sit in our pews today continue to be middle and upper class white people. On a more personal level, I see examples on a near daily basis of people irresponsibly engaged in personal conflict while calling it a free search for truth and meaning. To give an example, our current culture includes an element of what many have called calling out wrongs, of publicly shaming people we disagree with for even the smallest of infractions. There was an incident a few years ago known as hashtag Gamergate that started on Twitter, as you might, those who know about Twitter might be able to guess from the hashtag, but ended in feminist journalists and writers being harassed and even receiving death and rape threats simply for criticizing certain video games. And also, I would be remiss when so many of you are connected to academic culture to not mention how much call-out culture is being affected on college campuses right now, during which students call out even the smallest infractions among their fellow students and professors on social media without any regard for the consequences. Yes, like our neighbor, casual words uttered about situations we have not fully thought through can be devastating, spreading distrust into the wind. Our words, once they are out there in the world, cannot be taken back and will continue to affect wherever we spread them long into the future, even when forgiveness and reparation have been offered. Now, it's not that there aren't times to call out bad behavior as a form of accountability. Certainly the recent accusations of rape and sexual assault against men such as Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, and Roy Moore are examples of when such call-outs are necessary. But calling out people when we could more easily call them back in is a toxic behavior that breaks down trust and does little to encourage others to change the behavior we find so objectionable, whether they really should or not. Can we possibly justify such reactions as responsible? They're free, sure, but they do nothing to engender any sort of trust, relationship, or change. To paraphrase a colleague with whom I recently had a conversation on this topic, any search for truth and meaning that denies the other six principles is not responsible. Like our story this morning, the consequences of an irresponsible search for truth and meaning can devastate organizations as well. Adrienne Marie Brown, author of the brilliant 2017 book Emergent Strategy, suggests that what we sow at the personal level spirals out into the wider world. The seeds we plant with our words and actions have the potential to nourish the world or break it down, she says. So when our personal lives are full of toxicity, she says, this spills out into our families, our culture, and the organizations we are a part of. To quote her, what we all in our home and love realm enjoy shows up with our friends or our families or with our coworkers, bosses, or partner organizations. It is our pattern, our shape. Brown names some of the ways that people do this. She says, we learn to bond through gossip, venting, and destroying, rather than cultivating solutions together. We learn to manipulate each other and sell things to each other rather than learning to collaborate and evolve together. We learn to compete with each other in a scarcity-based economy that denies and destroys the abundant world we actually live in. And to borrow some of writer Mysha Z. Johnson's signs that a call-out is toxic, the behavior is not focused on the outcome, not in the best interest of the community, and it centers yourself. Such ways of being with one another break down trust and promote ways of being with one another and the world, which, if allowed to run unchecked, deny the basic humanity and interconnectedness of other people and pit us against one another. Yes, Brown believes, if we are to create real change in the world, we must find new ways to be with one another, new ways of being in the world that don't promote such toxic culture, more responsible ways. She believes you do not have the right to traumatize even abusive people, to attack them personally or publicly, or to sabotage anyone else's health. There is hurt in abusive actions, and while healing that pain is not your responsibility, exasperating it is not your justified right, she says. Brown suggests that we must constantly seek to understand the other by asking, on a daily basis, why? Through a frame of compassion. She believes that this can provide a basic framework for transforming the conditions around us. In the words of author Margaret Wheatley, you can't hate someone whose story you know. I dare say that a responsible search for truth and meaning requires each of us to understand one another better, especially when we don't agree with another person or when we're tempted to deny their humanity. Even supposed human monsters have pain and trauma behind their psychosis. This isn't to say that we should excuse other people's behavior or that there aren't consequences, but it is to say that we must learn to understand it. Had the neighbor sought to understand the man's behavior, he might not have made false accusations. I dare say there's probably some pain in the neighbor's background as well. We must understand him through the eyes of compassion, dignity, and trust. So I've been talking a lot about what a responsible search for truth and meaning doesn't look like. Let's talk about what it does look like. And for this, I turn to our congregation, All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's one of our largest physical congregations with 6 ministers, over 50 staff, 3 worship services every Sunday, and over 3,000 members. It's pretty large. Believe it or not, though, it's small for Tulsa standards. But a few years back, a man by the name of Carlton Pearson, a local black evangelical minister, made national news when he had an epiphany. He had been watching the story of the Rwandan genocide, and he suddenly had a crisis of faith. He had been preaching to his flock that anyone who doesn't know Jesus goes to hell. But how could he believe that in the midst of the Rwandan genocide, those innocent people had gone to hell? He said God spoke to him and made him a universalist. And there were consequences. He was excommunicated from his denomination, and 3/4 of his congregation left. Pearson would later say he had no idea he wasn't the first person to come up with this idea until All Souls reached out to him. They could have done a lot of different things, all souls could have. There's a lot of us who grew up in toxic evangelical churches in this movement. And we could have made they could have made assumptions. They could have decided that Pearson's congregation was vastly different or just wrong in their charismatic interpretation of Christianity. They could have chalked it up to the toxicity of fundamentalist Christianity. They could have found 1,000 different reasons to absolve themselves of why Pearson and his flock were different from them. But instead, they reached out to them, told them that universalism exists, and they entered into a long, long dialogue about truth and meaning. And when Pearson lost his building, they even offered him space on Sunday mornings. And a funny thing happened. Some All Souls members began attending the much more charismatic third service at the church. The bond became so close that when Pearson decided to leave for a new congregation, he instructed his group not to call a new minister. Instead, he told them to join All Souls. Today, All Souls is one of the few truly racially and theologically diverse congregations in our movement, and one of the only places where you can find a charismatic Unitarian Universalist service on Sunday mornings if you want to run through the aisles and shout for joy. And it's all because they decided to take a risk and not dismiss people who were different from them and reach out to people who on the surface seemed very different from them. All Souls' search for truth and meaning required them to reach out to others in times of need in order to be responsible. They did not dismiss Pearson and his congregation for being different or deny their inherent worth and dignity. They acted from a place of trust and compassion, and they are now a stronger congregation for it, with seminary classes even meeting there to explore how they did it. I believe that without responsibility, our search has the potential to destroy communities, churches, families, relationships, and even the world. But with it, we can strengthen every soul we touch. We need new ways of being with each other. I fully agree with Brown. Ways which are not currently being promoted by our larger culture, if we are to thrive, maybe even survive as a species. So to emphasize a point from a sermon a few weeks ago, you cannot engage in any behavior or believe whatever you want and be within the seven principles. What if our congregations, though, could promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning as a way of upholding our other principles? We are a covenantal faith, after all, dating back to the origins of our movement. So we've been talking about how to be in community for our entire existence. Maybe, just maybe, church is a place where we could learn to create and experiment with these new ways and be the change that transforms the world for the better. Maybe, just maybe, as my colleague Ashley Horan said in a sermon a few weeks ago, we can view everything we do at church, every worship service, every religious education class, every committee meeting, even board meetings, as an opportunity to learn how to be in community together, as an opportunity to transform ourselves, not as a place where we come to get something, but as a place where we come to give things back. May it be so.